Father Hardin, a member of the Society of Jesus, is professor of systematic theology at the Bellarmine School of Theology, Loyola University, Chicago, Illinois. He is author of many books and articles published in the United States, Canada, and Europe. His latest book is Christianity in the 20th Century. Father Hardin is a lecturer and consultant to various national, religious, and educational enterprises. He is renowned as a retreat master and spiritual director. Father Hardin.
The title of our second lecture is Why Catholic Schools? Not many years ago, it would have been irrelevant to ask, why Catholic schools? The answer would have been, why, of course. In the United States, the Catholic school system had an unprecedented size and influence, with over 5 million students in educational institutions directly under the church's auspices. What happened? Why should a book like Mary Perkins Ryan's have received so much publicity, or the Grassi Greeley reports have created such a stir in educational circles? The reason is that Catholic schools in America are in a crisis. And the sooner and more intelligently this fact is recognized and measures taken to resolve it, the better for the church and indeed for American society. On a personal note, I am the product of Catholic schools. 16 years before entering the Society of Jesus, and another 15 years after. But I have also been involved for more than 10 years in public education, as advisor and consultant to a variety of national agencies dealing with the problem of religion and public education. Moreover, I have spent 5 years teaching on the faculty of a state university, where most of my 2,000 students were going to teach in elementary or secondary public schools. Out of this dual experience has come a growing respect for Catholic schools and a deep concern over the crisis through which they are passing. In a single sentence, I would explain their critical status as the result of four converging elements: economic, cultural, psychological, and institutional. Where the economic has to do with financial support, the cultural with the pressures from a religiously neutral society, the psychological from inside the Catholic ranks, questioning the feasibility of formal Catholic education in an ecumenical age, and the institutional, also from the inside, affecting the identity of Catholic schools as authentically and not merely nominally Roman Catholic. I shall give a title to each of these four dimensions of the crisis as I go along, and that will be part one of my lecture. Part two will spell out what I consider the two main reasons why there should be, even must be, Catholic schools. First, the evidence of history, reflecting the Catholic Church's legacy to education in the past. And secondly, the possession of freedom in authentically Catholic schools to a degree and a depth that can only be approximated in schools that are run by the civil government. Note first the two levels of our analyzing the subject. First, the crisis, and then the answer to the question, why Catholic schools? Relative to the crisis, the first cause, we said, was financial need. The financial needs of Catholic education are too well known to deserve special treatment here. Without dwelling on the subject, however, certain aspects of the economics of church-related schools should at least be mentioned. It is sometimes objected that Catholic schools are in no worse financial plight than they were in the past. It is the favorite retort of those who oppose any government subsidy of church-affiliated institutions. If Catholics or certain Protestants want schools of their own, let them support this kind of education. Things are no different now than they were a generation ago, when religious day schools were mushrooming all over the country. That's the retort. Well, things are different. A financial hurricane has hit Catholic education on many sides. The government, on a state and federal level, has entered education on a scale unknown in the nation's history. Billions of dollars are being poured into school systems that, except for such subsidy, would either have gone out of existence or never reached the enrollment and excellence they now enjoy. This creates an awful imbalance in favor of tax-supported schools that is no longer even competitive. All the while, Catholics are affected by increased taxation, much of which goes to schools that Catholics do not attend. And in many states, the tax assessment is based on total school population, which adds to the public school revenue and further sharpens the financial cleavage. Finally, with increased resources for public schools, public officials keep raising the standards, as they call them, for education in terms of class size, accreditation, physical equipment, and facilities. The pressure on church-related institutions is a matter of common and sad experience. I have in mind a priest superintendent of a large central Catholic high school who was peremptorily told to cut his class enrollments, which were not large, or be denied approval by the State Board of Education. Second reason on the crisis level, cultural pressure. Equally significant with financial need is the growing pressure from outside Catholic circles urging church-related schools to fall in line and abandon their sectarian efforts to keep a divisive school system in operation. No estimate is possible of the number who see in Catholic schools a threat to American democracy. And in the words of a prominent educator, can no longer be humored as we might conscientious objectors in time of war. Catholic schools are admittedly too influential a segment of the academic world to be any longer tolerated with kindly patience. Those who argue this way do not insist that parochial and church-related schools be abolished. They are willing to admit that some variety is admissible, even desirable, provided it is kept within bounds. However, they insist that the public school, and the public school alone, as the ally of social tolerance, class fluidity, and the open mind, is so valuable that alternatives to it should at most be tolerated, but under no circumstances encouraged. Third reason for the crisis, psychological insecurity. As grave as our financial need and cultural pressure, they are minor compared with the newest phenomenon in American Catholicism, a psychological insecurity among certain bishops, priests, religious, and laity about the value of Catholic institutional education. I would place the source of this insecurity in the urge to conformity to the prevalent culture that Catholics now experience more than ever before in their American history. They have heard so much about ghetto mentality. They are beginning to believe the critics and are ready to prove their Americanism, if need be, in the most dramatic way possible by dissociating themselves from that symbol of religious ghettoism, the Catholic school. Yet behind this urge to conformity lies a deeper issue at work. The problem of maintaining intellectual respectability in a society that looks upon religious faith, especially in Catholics, as a sign of mental immaturity. The rising tide of secularism places a heavy burden on the conscience and courage of believing Christians in our age as in centuries past. No amount of rhetoric can obscure the fact that a growing number of Catholics in America are becoming acculturated, which means secularized, to the point that concern for nurturing the faith through Catholic schools is for them becoming less and less meaningful. The fourth reason for the crisis, institutional identity. It was inevitable, given this psychological insecurity, born of the urge to conformity, that even where Catholic schools have remained in physical existence, a growing number of them have lost or are fast losing their institutional identity. What do I mean by institutional identity? By this I mean that the educational institution, which calls itself Catholic, should be easily and certainly recognizable as such. In the directives and guidelines of the national, regional, or local boards of education, which set its educational philosophy, in the administration and teachers of the school, who are unquestionably loyal to the principles of the Roman Catholic Church, as articulated by the hierarchy in union with the Bishop of Rome, in the textbooks and curriculum of the school, which equally reflect the integrity of Catholic doctrine, worship, individual and social morality. No one knows for certain which of the foregoing four elements of the crisis is most fundamental. But in my judgment, the basic one is the last one. The emergence of what I call institutional ambiguity, where the name of a school, or even some of its external features, may still be ostensibly Catholic, but where the interior spirit which first created the institution and should still animate it is gasping for life, and in some cases may already be dead. So much for part one of my lecture, Why the Crisis. I now wish to address myself to the more fundamental question of why Catholic schools. As we pass from the question, why the crisis, to why Catholic schools, two reasons are paramount. One is the testimony of history. The other is the guarantee of freedom. Let me speak more briefly about the first, more at length about the second. And as I have been doing, I will give a subtitle for each of these two dimensions. The first I call the Church's legacy to education. In other words, the first answer to why Catholic schools can be answered in one sentence. Except for the Catholic Church, there would be no schools as we know them in the Western world. On the lower academic level, there had been public schools in the Roman Empire before the rise of Christianity, but these catered to the gentry, which, as we know, was only a very small fraction of the empire, and in time went out of existence for lack of competent personnel. There are records of a series of imperial decrees from the first century A.D. up to the fall of Rome, middle of the 5th century, raising teacher salaries, exempting them from taxation, and giving them extraordinary privileges in a desperate effort to save the schools. But to no avail. Public education disappeared with a general decline of an effete Roman civilization. In the confusion and turmoil that ushered in what are called the Dark Ages, the church assumed the task of education on a scale and to a degree that only now is being recognized by scholars. Cathedral schools came to be organized in connection with episcopal sees from the earliest centuries of Christian evangelization in Europe. Parish schools were legislated in every century by diocesan synods, by local and general councils, and with the rise of monasticism, monastic schools were founded to care for the children of rich and poor. Typical of the church's role in teaching the young is what happened in England at the time of the Reformation. When Henry VIII suppressed the English monasteries, he also put an end to what were called chantry schools, similar to those attached to monasteries. By actual count, having written an article for an encyclopedia on the subject, I had to go to the trouble of counting the number of chantry schools suppressed by Henry VIII. 2,374 were suppressed. And during the next 100 years, after the suppression, the only elementary schools in England were what was left of chantry education, but now taken over by the state. One of the ironies of history is that Catholics in the 20th century should be defending the church's right to run her own schools when it was the church which gave educators the very principles on which modern education is based. Having created the school from elementary grades to the university as her tribute to the human intellect in its desire for truth, the church still remains the school's best guarantor of that satisfaction of mind without which education, as I trust we are learning, is a sham when it does not become intellectual tyranny. So much for a very brief resume of the church's contribution to education of the past, and therefore the need for the church to remain in education. Otherwise, education, and I mean all education, is in jeopardy. But the second level of our analysis is what I entitle Freedom of the Human Spirit. The church's historical legacy to education is only the framework within which Catholic schools have operated since the civilizing of Europe and into modern times. Behind the legacy was the spirit which animated the Christian West to go into the field of education at all, in stark contrast with the larger and more densely populated Orient, where Christianity has made only a minimal impact. The spirit was a profound respect for man's freedom to use his mind in the quest for all knowledge, sacred and profane, and without hindrance from those forces which sought to inhibit intellectual liberty, often under the guise of liberation from dogmas and creeds, only to impose its own dogmas and creeds. The situation has not changed. Indeed, more than ever before, Catholic education needs to be fostered and the Church's institutions of learning encouraged, because they recognize the three essential freedoms of education that until recently were taken for granted and are now being challenged on every level, from K through 12 and from undergraduate classes through the professional school. They are the freedom to administer for the institution, the freedom to educate for the teacher, and the freedom to learn for the student and those responsible for his education. I will identify each freedom as I go along. Institutional freedom varies with inverse proportion to the variety of outside pressures that operate on the school administration. The more diverse and divergent the persons and agencies with a right to dictate a school's policy, the less liberty the school administrators have to set the standards, choose teachers, arrange the curriculum, and determine policies of admission and graduation. If I were to identify what I consider the single most important benefit of church-related schools, I would say it was this freedom to give the students some absolutes to live by, something to hold on to as the fruit of their education. For Catholic schools, it is the freedom to communicate the principles of Judeo-Christianity as the heritage on which our nation is built, and the code of morals by which a person may guide his life through time into eternity. Needless to say, this institutional freedom is being questioned in high circles. Catholic schools must withstand the subtle criticism from vested interests that are bent on depriving religion-centered institutions of their freedom to choose and abide by a Christocentric philosophy of education.
This conference is continued on Side B.